We're here today to interview George Johansson, who has farmed nearly all of his life in Clay County, south of Morehead. This has been a family farm operation involving his brother and sisters, his wife, and now his son, who will be taking over in 1985. George, what is your age?
65.
And George, where were you born?
Yulin, Minnesota.
Okay. And what year were you married, George?
In 1956.
Okay. How did you and your wife, or how did you and your family come to farm south of Morehead?
Well, we farmed out in North Dakota, moving from Morehead to out there. And then her husband died, so they wanted us to come and take over the farm.
Whose husband died?
Green's.
Green's husband. Okay, you said you were born in Yulin. How did you get from Yulin to North Dakota?
Yeah, but I moved from Yulin to Rusted.
Okay.
And from Rusted to south of Morehead, and from south of Morehead to North Dakota. We lost that farm.
How come you lost the farm? Do you want to tell us about that? What time of the...
1936, 35, we lost it. I suppose it was through the Depression.
Same as everybody else around you, pretty much?
Yeah.
Everybody had hard times and yep. Financially. Low farm prices?
Low farm prices, number one.
Yeah, I know what it was. Okay. What was life like on the farm where you live now before you came there? What was the operation and what was the setup?
Oh, it was different. They didn't have many cattle. When we came there, we had about 30, 40 head. We moved in there. They had like three, and they still had 8 horses.
Were they farming with horses at that point?
They used the horses only used to haul bundles, really, in the fall. They were still threshing. That's about all. And they, one guy would plow with the horses, finish up the strips.
Okay. What year was this about that you came there?
1942 we moved there.
Okay. So this was just about the time of World War II was going on.
Yeah, I was in the service. I'd been in a year already.
Okay, when did you get into the service, and how did that come about?
Well, there was two of us, so one of us would have to go, so I chose. And I went in January 10th, 1942.
You say there were two of us, you and your brother Olaf, right?
Yeah.
Okay. And you were farming at the time?
Yeah.
So that one of the boys could stay home and farm, is that it?
That's right.
And then you went into the service in 1941, you said?
42.
42. And you, what branch of the service were you in?
I went in the Navy.
And what did you do while you were in the service?
I rode the merchant marine ships.
Okay, what did you do on those ships?
I was taking men in the guns in case of an attack.
Okay.
First ship I was sunk on, I lost that.
That was your first ship out?
Yep, October 23rd, 1942, I was sunk.
Do you want to tell a little bit about the experience? It seems to me you've told me about that before.
Yeah, we got hit at 12:23. I just came off watch. And at 12 o'clock I came off watch. We got hit at 12:23. We went out and stood by our guns. And then about 4:05, they hit us with 2 more torpedoes. And we're supposed to take the life raft, and they didn't have them adjusted. Did the slant steep enough so they'd slide off? So we had to leave them and went for the lifeboat. And we got in the lifeboat, had to lower on the windward side because the other one was smashed from the torpedo. And the ship sank in 1.5 minutes. We drifted right over the top of it. The submarine surfaced. The number 2365 was painted on it. And, of course, the 7 German sailors held their guns on us, asked us for the captains what they wanted. He was in the water blowing the whistle, and one seaman got off the lifeboat because he'd been on a lifeboat before and was capsized. And he chose to get off because of the high seas, and if he hadn't, the captain would have lost his life. And he finally kept throwing the monkey fist to the captain. He caught the line, and I think he was in the water 3 or 4 hours. And when the submarine got this information, what cargo we had, where we came from, where we was going to, couldn't get the captain. He just submerged in the way he went.
But they came up and talked to you? They didn't shoot you or anything?
They didn't shoot us or nothing, no. This was in the Caribbean Seas. I landed in, we had 269 miles to land. They told us where land was and offered us medical aid if anybody seriously hurt. But mm-hmm. We had all this. Told us where land was and said, Heil Hitler, and down they went.
Mm-hmm. Didn't they also give your position to somebody to come and rescue you, too, then?
No, we had radioed in. They picked it up in New York, and he picked it up in London. But at that time, they were sinking 5 ships a day, and this PT, off in this Caribbean waters. So this PT boat could go out and pick up other survivors and run back in, and this is one reason it took them so darn long, and of course we were moving.
You were drifting, you mean?
Sailing, yeah. We had set sail. We only had 69 miles left before we would have hit land, but we were moving about absolute zero then.
I see.
So it might have took a long time. We had, I think it was 4 guys off the rocker. We was hanging on to them. Mm-hmm. If we would have sailed one more day, we'd have lost 2 men.
They were injured? Or?
Yeah, burned from the torpedoes.
Mm-hmm. So then they rescued you and brought you back?
Yeah.
Well, then you still stayed in the Navy and you went on and did a lot of work?
I still stayed in the Navy, went to sea. And at sea once I was attacked in Mediterranean, midnight. They missed us about 40 miles. They dropped the a rocket down. It lit it up just like broad daylight. Then we had time to get to our guns, so when we shot 2 airplanes down that night. Got credit for them. There was about 30 of us in. I don't know how we got the credit, but we did.
Okay. That's only 2 times you were attacked. How long were you then in the Navy?
That was 3 years and 8 months and 21 days.
And you got out, and then you came back to the farm?
Yep, and I come back to the farm.
And that's when you were in the area south of Morehead. That's where your family was, and you came back there to farm.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, what was things like then for your brother and your sisters then while you were away at war? And what was their life like on the farm?
Well, the first 2 years, they got rained out. They didn't have any crop. And the third year, of course, then they had a pretty fair crop. And so the life was really not good. Without a crop.
Without a crop, but were prices pretty good then for them otherwise?
Yes,
if they could have got a crop?
If they could have got a crop, but it rained so much. It just rained continuously, clear into November.
Okay. I want to go back and pick up a little bit. If I'm right, your sister married one of the brothers that owned this farm, and mm-hmm. then when her husband died and she was left with the farm and you came down to help her operate it, and your mother and dad were both living at that point too, were they not?
Yeah.
Okay, and your mother and dad, where did they get married, and how did they start life?
They got married at Glenwood because my dad has an uncle lived there.
Okay.
And they met on a farm. They worked on a farm south of Fargo, in south of 94. And they came from Norway, both of them.
Both of your parents came from Norway.
Yeah, and when they first got married, then they had to leave that farm for some reason, and they lived with Landine down by the river, Byron's grandpa, for one winter.
That'd be south of Morehead then?
Yeah.
Okay.
And then they started farming on the Finkel, by the Finkel elevator, 1911.
That would be about 6 miles south of Morehead at that time?
Yeah.
Okay.
And then they moved from there to Robert's farm. And that was sold in 1918 was a big crop, but then Dad got hailed out. He got nothing.
So life wasn't easy for them to get started either, then, was it?
No.
Then they had a fairly large family with you kids. It's 'cause
seven
how many,
of us.
How many boys and girls?
Two boys and 5 girls.
Okay. And what point did you kids be born then during this process of where your parents were getting started in farming?
What year?
Yeah.
See, my sister was born in 1911. Ole was born another year, I guess. Marie was a couple of years. Then Gladys was two or three years. There was a set of twins. They were born premature. They died.
Both of them?
And then come me in 1919 and my sister in by 1921 and my youngest sister in 1925.
Boy, that scattered out over a lot of years. Your dad must have got a lot of help then from you kids as he was farming and stuff as you grew up over the years. And
Oh, yeah, we all worked.
What did each of you do? How did you decide who had what job, do you know?
No, it was just set there to do it. We done it.
Raise cattle most
Raise
of those
cattle
years?
And milk cows, yeah.
Feed Hogs the cattle and bring in feed then, too?
Bring in feed, milk them.
In the wintertime, too, did you have feed to go out
oh,
and
yeah.
bring in?
Yeah, we done that before we went to school.
Yeah. Okay. As we were coming in, George, you mentioned that you'd gone to school here at MS. Can you tell me about what time in your life that you went here to MS?
I started in 1933 in the fall high school. And then in 1934, then I went to 35 in the spring, then I quit 2 weeks before school was out. So I only got not quite two full years of high school.
So you have about the equivalent of a 10th grade education then.
Yeah.
This is about where you went. How about your brothers and sisters then? Did they all
went to the 8th grade except my sister next to me, older. She finished high school and the two younger ones finished high school.
And the rest of you all had to go to work and help out on the farm?
We just went to 8th grade and quit.
And you had to work a full day then after that when school was on, so
like
you didn't have time.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's been a long time since you guys started farming then. You put in a number of years at it. Okay. Can you remember things, George, going back as to when you made the transition from horses to tractors?
Yeah, we bought our first tractor in 1934.
And do you remember what it was?
International, 1020.
What did you use the tractor for?
To plow. That was a bad deal. It was a three-year-old tractor sold to us for a new one. I think it actually was a new one, but it's picked off another dealer. And being it was our first tractor, we didn't know any better till in the spring it come to get $100, and we refused to contribute $100 to a three-year-old tractor.
Well, then what happened?
They took the tractor back. So we farmed with the horses until the fall of 1935, and then we bought a Model D John Deere.
How many acres were you farming at this point then?
Three quarters and then down to one quarter.
So you were able to handle it then with horses without too many horses. And what are the crops you raised in it about that time?
It was corn and wheat, barley, and usually flax and a few potatoes.
Mm-hmm. Well, then when you came to the area south of Moriad in the 1940s, what crops did you start raising there then?
We just raised grain, and then corn, of course, for the cattle and alfalfa hay. Then I started with 40 acres of potatoes. I grew them about 3 years, and then we switched to sugar beets.
Okay. Why did you quit raising the potatoes?
It was just hard work.
And no money?
No money.
Yeah, that sounds normal. When you started in the area of South Amoria, too, if I remember, you started with a combine almost right away, didn't you?
Yeah, we had combines in North Dakota, 5 foot Ellis Chalmers.
Can you describe a little bit about that combine? I can barely remember it.
It was called a all crop 60 Ellis Chalmers, run with a power takeoff shaft. And you went just as slow as you possibly could, but it was still thrashed more than a 24 inch thresher in a day with just one man, really, instead of five or six.
You didn't have to have shock it and bundle it or anything like that?
No, just cut it.
Did you straight combine with that, or did it windrow it?
No, we windrowed with used the 8-foot binder, and then made it to a 10-foot, which was a mistake because we had too much straw in the first place. And that was a good machine. Yeah,
used it for a long time, if I remember.
Yeah, we used that. We never used it in Minnesota. We left it and sold it to North Dakota. Because they had a wore-out case to use that wouldn't work. And so it was sold. I think we used it 2 years.
Okay, and then when you came here, you started combining. How would you handle your crops here then when you moved to South Des Moines?
Well, they had a combine, but it was wore out. It wouldn't work, and you couldn't get parts because Case was on strike. So they couldn't take it on trade because it was too old. It was worthless. And we just bought the John Deere combine outright.
If I recall, that was the one where a guy stood up on top in the front of it.
Two guys are running.
One guy on the tractor pulling it, and the other guy stood on top and ran the combine.
See, there was no hydraulic yet. That was the reason.
So then the guy up there had to raise and lower the platform to pick up the windrow?
Yeah.
Because that's the main job?
Main job.
Did he do anything then as far as adjusting the separator and that at the same time, or was he just busy doing that one job?
He would have, they had a million chains on it. He would oil them on the run.
Okay.
And to unload the auger, we put that on. He had to unload the, push the lever in gear that was on top of the combine to dump in the truck.
You had to stop then when you unloaded
it? Yeah, you didn't have to, but we usually did. Because it went so slow, you couldn't get a truck to run slow enough beside it.
What kind of trucks did you use then to haul your grain away from this combine?
36 Chevrolet and a 38.
And how many bushels about could you haul in there?
Oh, about 225.
Uh-huh. Seems to me one time you told me a tale about leaving one of those trucks out there and it rained. Can you tell me a little more about that?
That was during the war. I wasn't home then. And it rained. That thing leaked like a sieve, and I think the box was at least 2 feet deep. And it rained, had to rain the box full. The next day, it was still two-thirds full.
What happened to the truck then, sitting out there with all that water?
Well, we couldn't move it. We just left the water. It had rained so much, we didn't dare. If you'd move it, it'd sink, so we just left it there. It was left there until it froze.
And then you went out and got the truck out?
Yeah. The combine sat in the field till it froze. That was just on the edge. It had only went 40, 50 rods. And then they seen it was too wet. Well, I suppose it started raining. That sat there from August till I came home on leave after I was sunk in last of November.
And the combine was still sitting out in the field?
And I said, why does it sit there? And, no, I can't move it. It'll sink. That's on the highest place on the farm.
And that's one of the years that you lost a lot of crop then, I presume.
We lost it all that year, except 1,400 bushels of oats. We combined the same two bins full 2 years in a row.
And that's all you got off the whole farm?
That's all.
Yeah. Out of how many acres were you farming at that point?
800.
That was quite a loss for you then.
Yeah.
There any insurance or anything in those days to help you cover that kind of a loss?
They had insurance with the government. But we had to make a round and prove that what the yield, it was so muddy you couldn't even walk in it. And it was impossible. So we got nothing out of the government.
So then what did you live on in the
Well, we milked cows. And we had hay, and we bought some beet top out of your dad the first year. The second year we had a crop of alfalfa, and that's what they had to eat.
And then what you got out of your milk and cream check, that's what you lived on. You have chickens and hogs or anything
like that? Chickens and hogs.
And I suppose you slaughtered some of those then for your own use and to get by?
Yeah.
There must have been quite a few of you kids living at home at that point too then, were there not?
Yeah, there was just three of us that wasn't home.
And your dad and mom were still living then?
Yeah.
And what year did your dad die, do you recall?
Yeah, 1957.
Okay. How did you operate your farm when you and your brother and your sisters and your mom and dad were there? Did your dad, was he the operator and then you kids worked for him, or how did you divide it up?
No, it was divided four ways. And dad had nothing really to do with management.
I see. He just was kind of living with you kids. You boys were kind of operating the farm. And your sister then owned it, so you were kind of renting it from her.
Yeah.
I see. So that's kind of the way that farm South of Moyet has always been operated.
Yeah.
And then your brother, Ole, kind of retired when? About 82, 83?
No, he's been retired for he's 71, 4 years.
4 years? Be 81, then he retired. Yeah. 80 or 81.
Yeah.
And then you and your son, Gus, have been farming it since then?
Last 5 years. And Ole's been retired 5 years.
5 years. Okay. So then you've been operating as a corporation, G&G Farms, right? Why did you incorporate, and how, do you want to tell a little bit about how you brought Gus into the operation?
Well, he was the only son really owned the farm, and they all agreed to let him farm it and to hand the farm down to him. This agreement, we incorporated. Attorney said this is the best way to go.
That's what you're using as a vehicle then for transfer of the farm down to Gus someday.
Yeah.
As long as he stays there and operates it and farm. Because you've got a lot of nieces and nephews then, too, that would like to get in onto that, I'm sure. Okay. So you pretty much raise now wheat, barley, sugar beets. That's your main crops.
Yeah.
And now you're thinking of retiring too, I understand.
Yeah, I'm going to retire. I am retired, I guess.
And you're 65, and you're going to still help out and help Gus once in a while?
I will help, yeah.
And same with Ole. He goes out and gets on a tractor once in a while just to keep his hand in, something to do. Okay. Over the years, you've seen a lot of changes in farming, and you've talked about the equipment and different crops and stuff like that. But one thing maybe we forgot is when you got into sugar beets, why did you get into sugar beets, and how did your first year in sugar beets go?
Well, it was the only profitable crop at that time because the grain prices were bad. And one man, they had taken his acres away from him because beets were allocated then acres.
By the beet company, right?
Yeah, and because he had drowned it out, and they pulled the contract from him. So we went in, happened to come in, and they offered us 100 acres. We told them, no, we wouldn't buy machinery for that. We wanted 200, so they gave us the 200. And our first year, of course, they come with a new seed that made everybody get the same 10 ton. And we were thinking 14, but that didn't happen. But we did mechanical harvest them with a John Deere harvester.
And when you planted them, you had labor to come in and thin them and weed them and take care of them.
Yeah, we had 11 workers come in to hoe.
Those same people stay with you, or does that get to be a different crew? Or
they were just with us 1 year. We had problems with them. And then we got another bunch. They've been with us. They're still with us.
Okay, you want to tell who they are? And
yeah, P.E. Garcia and his wife, and he eventually had 12 children one of the years he worked for us. Been 30. And now he has about three children left. All the rest are either married or got school teacher jobs and so on. And they stay in Texas, different parts.
They don't come up here anymore.
They don't come here and work anymore.
And he still comes up and works, holds your beets?
He still comes up.
His job has changed a little over the years, too, though, as it hasn't got so much to do anymore as he had to do then. Isn't that right?
Oh, yes. The chemicals have helped them an awful, awful lot. Yes.
Do you ever have any years when it was really tough for them to clean up your fields or anything like that?
You ain't a kidding. If I'd have been him, I'd have went to Texas. The weeds is taller than him, but he still stayed and hoed.
Yeah, it seems to me 1 year you even had to destroy some because it would rained and stuff and the weeds got ahead of you. And
we plowed under about 20 acres, and we were lucky. That was the year we dug till Thanksgiving, the year we bought the plant. Year before, and okay. I said, we went in, ate Thanksgiving dinner, and I said, by gosh, no more sugar beets. I was done. So if we wouldn't have bought the plant, I'm sure I wouldn't be raising sugar beets. I just couldn't see it 3 months to dig 200 acres of beets. It's crazy.
You started in September and hauled out into November.
Yes, Thanksgiving.
Yeah. Has there been a lot of years that you've hauled into November, though?
Just that was the second time. But there was a first part of November. That happened because of continuous rain in October. Mm-hmm. But then it was just the latter years they contracted more and they wouldn't put more unloading facilities in.
You worked with your neighbor, Paul Johnson, across the road. How did this come about being? Do you recall?
Yeah, in 57 was a tough year to... No, before that. 55 it must have been. It was a tough year to dig. And he came over and asked if we'd help finish him up. Him and Sillars worked together, and they were having a problem digging. So we went over and dug his half and hauled him. So the next spring he asked if I'd plant him. And so I worked with Paul until he retired.
Got any idea how many years you worked together with him?
I suppose it was 55 till... Must have been at least 10.
10 years. You planted the crop, and as I understand, Paul did the cultivating and took care of the weeding and stuff. And then in the fall of the year, yeah, you harvested together.
Yeah.
Paul provided a truck, and you provided
the harvester. We'd charge him for digging, and we'd pay him for hauling.
He'd haul your beets in return as well as his own.
Yeah, that came out pretty good.
Didn't have too much cost then. You trade too many dollars between you.
No.
Okay, now we've had an agreement since about, what, 1965, where we've been working with you, and and you want to maybe tell the people a little bit about that, how that works.
Well, we bought a tandem truck, and I was talking with Bob's dad, and he said, I'll buy one, we'll run two of them 24 hours. And, of course, getting unloaded was the reason of the tandem truck, get a bigger load. So then we had two of them, and this did help. We came in with 12 or 13 tons of load versus 8. And then Emil retired, and then we're still hauling with each of us old two trucks. And we trade back and forth. The trucks run night and day, which is a good thing. You can run them 10 years, and then probably trade them off.
It's kind of worked out pretty well because we hire drivers and put in the trucks that haul for you. And our trucks, we hire drivers for our own trucks on both shifts. You hire drivers for both shifts. And then we run four trucks under each of our own harvesters during our shift. And we each own our own harvesting equipment other than the trucks. But we just use each other's trucks for 12 hours. So it's really saved us a lot of money in license and tires and stuff that we would have to buy. So that's been a real bonus.
Tremendous, because we'd have to owe four trucks. Four good trucks.
Yeah. When you started in the 30s, I think we've talked about some of the economics and that and how things were tough for your folks and that. What do you think caused some of these things back in the 30s to go bad? What?
Well, when you lose your entire crop, like, say, in 1918, say they'd only farmed for 7 years.
Mm-hmm.
And then you lose your whole entire crop. You don't harvest nothing. That knocks you out. And then he had to move, of course, to Yulin. And that cost money.
Mm-hmm.
And then the fellow he rented the farm from wouldn't put in a well, so he got mad and moved to Rusted, which he really should have dug his own well, and it wouldn't have cost no more than moving down there. Because he'd farmed, his farm was in pretty good shape. And he would have, should have, that hindsight is good. He should have stayed there.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose if they'd all switched to the tractors in the early 20s, the tractors were good from, the International tractor was good in 1923, and the John Deere in 1925 was a good tractor. And, but they weren't mechanically minded. So that wouldn't have worked.
Prices were good. You could have bought the tractors and paid for them in the 20s then?
The prices were good, yes. And they were up and down, just like anything else, but they weren't that bad. And your cost, it was a lot cheaper to farm with a tractor than a horse, but to get somebody that never had this, it's pretty hard to drill it through his head.
Mm-hmm. Didn't realize that you didn't have to feed that tractor when it was parked in November through into March or April.
That's right.
Where the horse you had to feed and fix harness and still take care of him. A lot of hard work.
And do very little work in a day.
Then a part of your production of your farm had to go to feed those horses then too,
right? It took perhaps a third of it to feed the horses.
Well, then when we got into the 1930s and prices went bad, what do you see there? What caused those prices to go down so bad?
Well, it's just like probably today, a world surplus of grain. Yeah, I think I read once wheat was cheaper in 1932 than it had been since 1497. World wheat was 32 cents a bushel, and 1497 is 47.
And what about the other commodities like potatoes and onions?
Yeah,
and
well, the potatoes weren't even worth digging. You couldn't even sell them.
So the farmer just left them in the field?
A lot of them left them. Some dug. And then hauled them out back out to the field. Onions, too. And like in 1932, if you shipped a cow to St. Paul, you paid the freight and more, and you would lose $6. You'd be better off to shoot the cow. You'd save $6.
That doesn't happen too often. Well, how about in the 1940s, and we talked about during the war?
Well, as soon as 1939, then wheat started up. Hitler moved into Poland, invaded Poland. And wheat went from 79 cents, and then in the spring it was up to $1.19. And it kind of hung in there, and then in the fall you could get $1.25 for wheat.
How many farmers were smart enough in that fall then when it was at 69 cents and went up that they hung on to it? Or did they sell right away?
No, it was 79 cents. You could borrow 65 cents a bushel from the government, and the most of them hauled to the elevator and go and get a loan. We did. And then we sold in the spring the wheat for $1.15 and paid off the loan.
So they did benefit by that price increase then?
Yeah, the most of them did. And
that's the thing that seems to be so hard today. That's, you look at the price, and when it goes up, what are you going to do? Are you going to hang on to it or sell it?
He's tough now, tougher now today than I was then.
What happened through the 50s and 60s, and how did you view farming on your farm in those years economically?
Well, it was the sugar beets that carried us. The grain made us very little money, I'd say, after the 50s. And it was nothing until the Russians bought in the 70s, and then the grain got too wild. That's what's hurting us today. They should have froze wheat at $3.
That way, why do you say that, George? What have?
Well, in that fall, remember, we was paying $350 for anhydrous ammonia, the last of it. And we had to spend that money to put it on because we had to give it for income tax. Otherwise, we'd have shut back. Well, we wanted a good crop the next year. But if we'd have froze wheat at $3, fertilizer was started out at $55. And in before October, it was $350 the last we bought. It would have stayed probably at $55.60.
The dealer kind of knew you had the money and you had a tax problem, and he was going to help you out.
He helped us out, sure.
How about machinery in those 1970s?
No, they didn't escalate too bad until the following year, 73-74. Then they would raise machinery like 3, 4, 5 times a year. And farmers would even argue against each other what he paid for a tractor. You could buy one week, and next week it was 10% higher. And, of course, they've been going since.
How was availability of equipment during that time when they were raising the prices?
Yeah, they were hard to get, especially John Deere. That's why we ended up with a case. You couldn't even get one.
You have put your name on a list and wait? Or
You could go in and order it, yes. When it came in, you got it. That would be, if you ordered in the summer, you sure wouldn't get it that year.
You'd have to plan a year ahead to buy a tractor at that point.
Not a John Deere, especially.
How about the other equipment dealers? Did they have the same kind of problems?
They could sell everything that came in.
How about the equipment and the plows and discs and planters and combines?
Yeah, it was all the same.
Just like the tractors, anything you wanted. Okay. You've never been involved yourself in political office. You've never run for anything?
No.
But you've known a lot of politicians in Clay County over the years.
Yeah.
I'm sure you've known a lot of county commissioners. Do you want to give me the names of any that you're most familiar with?
County commissioners?
Yeah. Well, Merle Allen was a neighbor of yours.
Yeah, Merle Allen, yeah.
He was on for quite a while.
And Brantner, of course.
Casey? Or his dad?
Casey. And Eldon Thompson but his brother.
Arvid Thompson?
Yeah, Arvid, yeah. And they've done a good job, all of them. It's a tough job.
Do you ever have any things that you had to go to the county commission and meet with them on? Or?
Yeah. Once we went up to the courthouse and met with them on drainage problem.
Okay, what was the problem?
Well, I tried to get the culvert cleaned out. And I got permission from my neighbor to run it, which I didn't really need, but I asked him if it was all right. And, of course, they were pretty reluctant about doing it, so then I hired a guy, and then, of course, one of the county guys drove them off, so I still didn't get it cleaned. So it never got cleaned. So then this past fall, my son, of course, he got a hold of it, and he got it cleaned out and done a real good job and without any arguments. And it drains good.
Okay. Drainage has always been kind of important here in the valley because it's so flat, right?
Yeah.
And so over the years, you've had a lot to do with draining your farm and getting it in shape. Do you ever have any experiences with that that are unusual?
I guess not really. They do windstorm come up. I can't blame my neighbor because ours blew and his started to eventually and filled the ditch in. And I went over and asked permission to clean the ditch and haul it on his beet field, and he said, go ahead.
Yeah.
And so that was a good friendly term, and I cleaned it just enough to get by, and then in the fall I got it down to the where it was, so it should drain good.
Yeah. That's important, isn't it, to have good drainage when it's this flat?
Oh, yes, we need drainage, boy.
What happens when you don't have drainage?
It drowns out, especially sugar beets.
Is that probably some of the problems you had back there in the 40s when it was so wet, or did it just continually rain so much?
In 43 and 44, no matter how much drainage you had, you wouldn't have got a crop. It was too humid to combine, and we had no dryers. And, of course, that's the letters I got. And when they did finally combine a little bit, and then it was too wet, and then it rained like 6 inches in a night, mm-hmm. and the next day she'd rain another two. Just every night in a week it rained.
Mm-hmm. You've always had pretty good relations with your neighbors, and we were talking about county commissioners and that. You never really had any problems with anybody in government of any kind then?
No. They've always, whenever we've asked them for help, they've done what they could for us.
Okay, when you say asking for help, I want to go back and when you came to the farm, there weren't roads like there are today. There were some pretty low mud trails down through there. You know, how did you go about getting these roads built, and what did you have to do?
Well, we finally got a new crew in the Moore Township. That was the number one help. And we asked for the road south of us graded, the one past our farm, and then the one to the east graded. And to gravel, too, and they did.
You say a new crew, you meant the township board got
in. Town board, yeah.
And why were they willing to go along with this? It must have cost a lot of money to build roads and get them graded up and graveled.
Well, they saw it was necessary because it was to the point where anybody that wasn't acquainted, they drove in and got stuck, and I got the chance to pull them out. It got so bad I couldn't go down and harvest. I couldn't get to the field.
And that was driving on the road. It was better driving across the field.
I could drive if I could get out in the field. If I had to drive out in the field to get to my field, the field was better than the road because the road would have a slough in it. Mm-hmm. And that's the only way I could get out to the field. A lot of times, I drove out in the field with the.
Well, you built the road then as transportation to and from the field. You didn't build the road to make a ditch or to drain your farm.
Not for drainage. We had drainage. We didn't need that. The only thing we needed was a road to drive on.
Then when you would harvest in the fall of the year, you had to have roads to get this crop off and get it into the farmstead or to the elevator, or when you raised sugar beets to get it to the beet plant.
Yeah.
And it was necessary. How about for things like the mail route and the school bus and things like that? Did they also need roads?
Yeah. We had no need for a school bus past our place in them days, but they sure needed it since.
Mm-hmm. And when you did need a school bus later on and your son was born and you were married, you built a house there right alongside of your brother and sister's farm instead and lived there. Your son went to school in Moorhead, right?
Yeah.
And he went through high school?
Yeah.
Did he go to any further education?
No.
He quit at the end of his high school career. And then he went to work for you on the farm, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, now he's going to be taking over the farm. And you have any feelings about him taking over?
Well, I guess I'm a little concerned.
Typical parent?
Yeah.
He's not taking over in the easiest of times, of course. We know that things are going to be tough for him because prices are tough right now and
costs are high.
So you're
Yeah, I think he's really got probably as bad a time to take over a farm as any time in my life, actually.
Yeah, that's quite true.
Because when I was big enough really to know anything about farming, prices was on the rise, and we was getting a better grain, resistant to rust and so on. And so things was on the up. And, of course, we all knew we was eventually going to go to war. We knew that in 1937, Amelia Earhart was shot down or
was lost.
Lost. Right away, we knew the Japs was going to jump us one day. And we should have been better prepared. That was the rumors then. They said just drop one bomb on Japan, the whole island would burn, but they found out different. Mm-hmm.
You mentioned wheat varieties and that. What varieties did you raise back in those days?
In the 30s, we had the series. Like Emil Karlsson said, that really got serious by 1937. Yes, there was a lot of straw, and the rust took it. That was all.
It seems to me a lot of fellows had it. Wasn't that the variety that it got to the point where the rust got so bad that they didn't get a crop off of it? And then it was finally then that they decided to change varieties?
Yeah, Thatcher came out in 1935 in the fall, and it was available in 36.
Did everybody plant it then in 36?
In 36, there were a lot of series planted, and some of the series was good because of the drought. Mm-hmm. And 37, they said, well, it was pretty good last year, we'll try it this year. And they should have went to Thatcher. Thatcher out-yielded the series by twice.
How about since then? Have there been any big changes in varieties?
Oh, yes, yes, yes. In 1957, when I told my dad, that's the first we started with nitrogen fertilizer. I was going to raise 50 bushels of wheat. He said, oh, you thought I was crazy. And if he'd have lived, he could have saw 50 bushels of wheat that fall. But best to wait.
You can't have been that close to that time. And how about in the barley and stuff that you've raised? Been some changes there, too?
Barley always did yield pretty good, though. Yeah, I don't think we could raise 70, 80 bushel of barley or 90 way back in the 30s. Hmm. And but that they would wear out as far as the malting quality.
And you've always raised malting barley?
Yeah, tried to.
Mm-hmm. Even when you were feeding animals and stuff, you still raised a variety that would work for malting?
Yeah.
And you've always sold barley then, besides when you were feeding cattle and stuff? Or you...
Yeah, we'd always have enough to sell. Well, we'd raise corn, and then we'd oats, and we'd mix oats and corn to feed the cattle.
I see. Did you grind it on the farm and feed it?
Yeah, at our own hammer mill.
Okay. And as you got into sugar beets then, there was a lot of changes in varieties there over the years, were there not?
You're not kidding.
Did you start out when they had the multi-germ seed, or were you on a single-germ seed?
Multi-germ.
And many plants grew out of a single seed and continued on down the line. That must have been a lot of fun, thinning those, huh?
Yeah, it was.
You've had some experiences over the years, too, with seed varieties. When they got to the single-germ seed and you could space plant it, then you went to a thinner. And what are your views on thinners?
Well, we went to space our single germ seed and then thinning. That worked good because we had no chemicals that would really kill the weeds. And that where the thinner went, it would knock them out so it could speed up the operation for the labor. And then when they came with the chemicals and then the space planting, 6 inches apart, and regardless what they test, 92 or what, half of them grow. Mm-hmm. So if you come up with a foot apart or so, that's pretty good. If you plant them later, I think you'd get a few more. But we've space planted now, and cost of seed is $14, $15 a pound, we use a pound and a quarter versus we would be using 2.5. And we haven't suffered from yields.
And that's worked out quite well for you then. Okay. You've always been involved in going to the church, and you and your wife have been quite active in church. You want to tell us a little bit about what your background in church has been?
Well, it wasn't much until I got married, I guess. I just went occasionally, and then we got married. I didn't belong to any church, but we always went to the Swedish Lutheran. My sisters, two of them, were confirmed in there, and so we had to have a church. So after the pastor Olson married us, we started going there, and then he came on and asked to join, so we did.
Were you confirmed and baptized in
the Lutheran
church? I was
baptized. I took instructions over there at the church. I never was confirmed.
Never was. Were you baptized then?
Yeah.
And what church were you baptized in?
I was baptized at the Rusted Church, what do you call it? I was baptized at home by the Rusted minister.
I see. Was that a Lutheran minister?
Yeah.
So you've always been Lutheran then in your family all through your life?
Yeah.
Your parents were never really active in church then, I take it, being that you kids
no,
were
not. No, not since, no.
But now your family has all gotten on to the Lutheran church, and you all kind of go to the Lutheran churches, whether it's Bethesda or Good Shepherd or someplace like that, and you've all kind of gone with the Lutherans. Okay. And your son then was baptized and confirmed at Bethesda, right?
Yeah. He was baptized at home, but he was confirmed at Bethesda.
You think that the church has had an influence on your family?
Oh, definitely, yes.
You want to say how it's influenced your family life?
Well, I think it brings people closer together.
Okay. When you live as close as you do to Moorhead today, you're only about a half, well, the city's right on the north side of your farm right now. And has this changed your life as the city has grown out to meet you?
Yeah. I got so much traffic passed. I got a shorter to town. And, of course, the better road's almost paved all the way. But I get a lot of traffic, and a lot of traffic I don't like. It's kids just chasing around.
What's the problem with the traffic? Cars go up and down the highway all the time, George. Is it the dust or the noise?
The dust.
The dust.
And some of them are just joyriding. Yeah, noise. The young ones got the noisy cars.
Have any problem with them going in the ditch?
Yeah.
Probably that. You must have a pretty good relationship with the city of Moorhead now. I noticed that you planted trees last year and you cooperated with the city. You want to explain how that came about?
Well, we asked the city about it because of the 30th Avenue is lower than the field 4 feet, and that fills with snow. So we offered to plant the trees to their specs distance-wise and to stop snow if they would help out paying for them. So they agreed to pay for them and water them. And that one row.
That's just the one up there by the city?
One up by the city.
But you planted a whole bunch more trees on your farm.
Yeah.
How many?
We got 9 rows in a mile and a half.
9 rows a mile long?
Yeah.
What varieties of trees then did you plant in there?
Well, there's evergreens in there, and then there's cottonwood, and 1, 2, 3 are evergreens. I think there's 2 cottonwoods. I can't even give you the names of some of them. Mm-hmm. But the rabbits was pretty tough on the cottonwood.
Last winter?
No, this past summer. We had so many of them out there. They would chop them off. So the soil conservation is going to check it out, and maybe we have to replant in there.
Individual trees then?
Yeah, I think, though, in the down the road, the trees will be beneficial to keep the soil there, number one. And if you go to the soil conservation, you can Lynn Anderson's, you can see his results. You can't even believe it's possible.
That was the reason you went into the tree rows with soil conservation?
Soil conservation, number one.
And then you were helping the city out. As long as you were planting trees, you helped them out up there and putting one in. That's going to be pretty up there, too, because you have a lot of evergreens mixed in there, and it'll eventually be a real good snow catch.
The cottonwoods will come out after the evergreens get so big.
Then you're going to just chop them out? And
chop them out and kill the tree.
And harvest them out. Okay. You didn't plant any elms because of the Dutch elm disease problem then, I take it. Yeah. How about before this period, George, in the city, as they moved out there, you ever have any concerns about the city getting closer to you?
I never dawned on me. I never thought I'd see the day they'd be that close.
You didn't think the city could grow that fast, huh?
No, I just couldn't believe it.
Must have been a little bit of a surprise to you then when your neighbor to the north of you sold out and the city was all of a sudden right on your doorstep.
Yeah, it was.
How did that come about to be? Do you want to relate that?
Well, I guess they've been dickering on buying that farm from them for quite some time, and I suppose it was a price they had to agree on. And of course, the price he got, you know, was unheard of. Anybody would have sold land then. And the contract they wrote up with him, why, he'd be dumb not taking it.
Didn't he have some problems with the drainage on that farm also at the same time?
No. After 94 came in, his drainage problems was cured right now. That could have been cured but the city of Moorhead didn't want that water coming in on the south side. That could have been cured for $100 worth of digging.
How do you mean? Where would they have run the water?
And could have went west, that water.
Along the county road there?
Along the county road. If they'd have taken 3 feet off in that middle there, it would have went west to beat the bend.
And let them go all the way to the river, then it would have drained it. Otherwise, where did they want it to go?
The city wanted that ditch to go around town and to the north.
Around the east side and then north and into the city instead of going straight west.
Yep.
And they opposed that, and so therefore, okay. Basically, though, has the city been hard to deal with over the years?
No, I think they've been good.
You've had a lot of time to see the city of Moorhead come up and grow. Used to be some implement dealers in town, a lot of hardware stores and places you did business with, and they're not there anymore. Do you want to relate a little bit on what's happened and why the city hasn't kept them?
Well, I suppose it's our workman's comp that's number one in our taxes. It's chased the implement dealers over to Fargo. And the one we had, he couldn't make a go of it. The company, Minneapolis Mean, finally went out of business. They couldn't keep up with the change in times.
So you just have to go a little further to get parts and services now in these days, right?
Yep.
And, of course, with the transportation, what it is now, it's not as hard to drive over to Fargo and get them as it was. Imagine when you first started farming, you thought a little more about how far you had to go to get parts.
Oh, you bet you did. Yeah. I can remember traveling with the horses in a wagon.
To go get parts.
Get parts. It took longer to get the parts than it did to put them on.
Where did you go then in those days to get parts? Clear to Sabin? Did you ever manufacture things on your farm, make parts, or try to do things?
No, not to any great extent.
Okay. Basically, a lot of our services come out of Moorhead. Our fuel, fertilizer, and we have the beet plant in Moorhead. You have the elevator in Moorhead. So basically, you've done a lot of business in the city of Moorhead then, haven't you, over the years?
Oh, yeah.
You've seen a lot of change in Moorhead. Can you tell me what your impressions are of the changes? Have they been for the good?
Yeah, I think they have, yes. It's too bad the city gets so big up north, got too close to our beet plant, or else we should have been quicker on the trigger and bought the land adjacent to the... We could have bought it, but we chased them houses out of there. And just, they could have made a golf course, anything they wanted about it.
What do you see as a conflict between the houses and the beet plant?
Well, it's the odor and the scene they don't like. I don't know why don't have to look over there.
Okay. Going pretty good. Have you belonged to very many farm organizations in your years in farming?
Oh, yeah. I belong to Farm Bureau, Farmers Union, NFO. That's about it.
Do you see any benefits to belonging to any of these organizations?
Today, I don't. Really don't.
Why don't you see it? What's the problem?
I guess I could buy out a farmer's union without belonging to them. And, of course, that's, you know, they have a cheaper product, that's number one. Mm-hmm. And any dividends, money earned, goes back to me. And I don't know, Farm Bureau, they had a business and that closed, so they can't do me any good.
How about NFO?
Yeah, I done well with them, but I didn't like the idea of putting the grain in them bins and then loading them in cockeyed semis.
When you talk about them bins, those are your farm bins, or?
Yeah, and they didn't come at one, they come at three or four of them. That gets to be too big a hassle. That was an idea number one, but I did get from 10 to 20 cents a bushel more than the local elevator.
Of course, NFO is still active today, but are you still active with NFO?
No, I dropped, signed out.
Signed out. You were in it, you went in it to market your grain then, as I take it.
Yeah.
And you felt you could get a better price than that. Basically, then, did you sign a marketing agreement before you planted the crop, or after you harvested, or when did this take place?
No, you would just call them and you wanted to sell X number of bushels. And when they got a contract, they'd let you call you back. We'd send a truck.
Did they set the price, or did you tell them what you wanted for a price? Or
they would, well, they knew the elevator price. They'd tell me what I'd get. Some of the elevators cooperated, then that was nicer. They'd haul into the elevators, pay them 7 cents, they'd ship it by rail. That worked pretty good. Cragness handled quite a lot of NFO grain, sunflowers, they still do.
Mm-hmm. Otherwise, they had to come to your farm and you had to load all those semis in one shot.
Yeah, that's too much.
Mm-hmm. That happened during the winter or in the spring?
During the winter, during the summer, depends on when you wanted to sell your crop.
If you were busy in the field, you'd have to come in and help load those trucks then.
You'd work clear until sometimes till dark.
Have you used any of the things like the county agent services over the years?
Oh, yes. I went in quite a few times and asked the county agent on advice and this and that. And couldn't say I always agreed with him, but but I got his opinion.
Okay. Did you ever get any benefits out of going through the county agent then, or?
Yeah, I've learned a few things. I learned when you plow sweet clover down, you don't go in there and dig it deep. If you're going to get a benefit from your clover, then you've wasted your clover.
You get into any of the meetings that the county agents have that you go to and learn about farming?
Yeah, I was to one on soil conservation this spring, which was quite interesting. This no-till, I'd never go for no-till. I'd never get anything seeded, never dry out. Mm-hmm. But I think minimum till, but not no-till.
Mm-hmm. Of course, being involved in sugar beets, you also have a sugar beet specialist to help you answer your questions on herbicides and weed control and that. You ever use those services?
Oh, yes. I always consult with them to see.
What do you think has been your biggest source of information over the years on how to farm? You must have learned to keep up in order to stay in business.
Well, I think to the local county agents and so on, and then your farm journal magazines and so on, farmer magazines. I think I've gotten as much information out of them as anyone.
Have you read pretty much the same magazines over the years?
Yeah, same ones.
You subscribed to several then?
The Farm Journal and The Successful Farmer and The Farmer.
That's the three major ones that you read. Okay. Very good. Have you ever been involved in anything in the way of the county fair?
No.
Never have taken any of your crops down and showed them? Okay.
I guess only to the seed show, and that was because of the 4-H kids came and got seed and took down, and they all took some oats and barley down and won first prize.
You didn't even do anything with it.
I didn't even know. I just gave them the oats.
No, that's all right, George. Well, have you ever had any major accidents or things like that happen on your farm in your lifetime?
No, sir, I've been...
Been very lucky.
Been darn lucky.
You and your family have all been healthy and safe through all the years. Yeah. That, so. Okay. Well, I think that kind of winds it up for us today. And thank you for coming down and being interviewed, George.